Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to a brand new Arsblog Arscast right here on arsblog.com. How are you? Hope you're well. Thank you for being here. As always, another week has gone by. We're heading into a Premier League weekend. We play Leicester City away from home. That is going to be a tricky game, but we go into it on the back of a 2-0 win in midweek against Leeds in the Carabao Cup, keeping the momentum going a bit. We'll be talking a bit about that later on with our second guest of the day, James Benge from CBS Sports, will be along to talk some of that midweek action as well as some of the bits and pieces that have been doing the rounds in the football world this week. But before we get to James, we do have another guest, and a very special guest it is too, which is why I'm just going to crack on with today's show with minimal waffle. He is a man who played over 560 games for Arsenal. He lifted 8 major trophies and he kept countless clean sheets. It's my pleasure to welcome to the Arscast David Seaman. Hi, how are you?
Yeah, I'm not too bad, thanks. Yeah, good.
Good. Listen, you have been recently doing some work with the club. There are some pictures of you at the training ground. What exactly was going on there? I mean, how did that come about?
Well, it came about through an invite that I had from a long time ago. I was doing a photo shoot at the training ground, and some of the youth team coaches came in and asked if I'd be interested in going in. And this was pre-COVID, and I said, yeah, I'd look forward to that, and then nothing happened for a while. And then luckily I met my two ex-physios in Gary and Colin Lewin on doing Soccer Aid, and they asked if I'd been in. I said, no, I said, I've not heard anything. And then they got in touch with Pear, and then Pear got in touch with me. And now it's something that I do, whenever I get a chance. I'm just going in like mentoring, just watching, and just, if they want to ask me any questions, then it's fine, I've got a lot inside of here that could be used for someone.
Yeah, well, for sure. Plenty of experience. I mean, it sounds fairly informal. So are you working with, let's say the younger players, the youth team players?
Yeah, with the under-18s, the under-23s, all at the training ground. And then sometimes I go over to the first team as well and watch them. And, and if they want to ask me any questions or if I spot anything, they want me to interrupt and just, if I see anything that's worthwhile, then say it. Don't just go there and watch. I'm there for help. They know that. If they need anything, if they need to talk to me about how to deal with certain situations, then I've got a lot of experience.
That is true. I mean, there is we can talk about the technical aspects of goalkeeping, which I think have changed over the years. The way that the position has modernized, if you like, over the years has been quite interesting. But I suppose one aspect of it as well is the mental side of it. Is that something where you feel like you can really contribute? Because if you make a mistake, for example, as a goalkeeper, I'm sure it can get on top of you pretty quickly, but you've still got maybe 85 minutes or 60 minutes or a whole game to play after that. Is that something where you feel like you could bring a lot to the young players and also the first team goalkeepers?
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah, especially the youngsters, because they've never experienced the pressures that I have and people like Bernd and Aaron. Playing in the first team for Arsenal is massive. The pressure is huge. Aaron's now doing it with England as well, so he's taking it step by step. And yeah, like you say, it is a big part of it, because if you make that mistake in the first 5 minutes, can you control yourself? Can you deal with it and then still perform? I've seen Pickford do it. I've seen him do it, make a mistake in the first 5 minutes, but then went on to be man of the match. When I see something like that, I think to myself, well, mentally, he's really tough, and he can handle it. And, where do you get that mental toughness from? And that's hard, but you've got to have things in place so that when you do make that mistake, don't then start thinking, oh, I've got to make a save or I've got to take a cross to recover from that mistake. You know, it's not, because if you start thinking, I've got to do this, then you'll end up making another mistake. You know, it's building it brick by brick, just little bits. Even to the point of, like, when the ball comes to you, make sure that even if it's a throw or a kick, you know, that it's on target. It's where you want it to go. It doesn't have to be a big match-winning save. It can be anything that just builds up that confidence again. And, yeah, with goalkeepers, a lot of it is mental, because you just stood there. You're waiting. The ball has to come to you. You can't go and get the ball.
Yeah. But that is...
So that's the tough part about it, you know, and it does take some getting used to, but the more you play, and I've always said to the goalkeepers, you need to play. I said, you can't be training all your career. You have got to play, because there's so many different decisions come up in a match that don't happen in training. You know, so the more experience you get, the better you'll be.
How closely allied is, you know, that character, that ability to compartmentalize a mistake and deal with, you know, the pressure that, you know, like there's 60,000 eyes looking at you who've just made a mistake. But how close is that with your technical ability, like confidence in your ability as a goalkeeper to do the things that a goalkeeper has to do, catching, kicking, punching, making the saves, distributing the ball? I mean, you can have all the character and personality in the world, but if you can't do that part of it, it doesn't really matter.
No, you've got to have the technical side of it. There's no doubt about that. And that can be coached. You know, when you see goalkeepers, they love just doing, I call it kick catch. You know, we kick it at each other, catch it, you know, and just through catching it, you know, like just here, round about here, just catching it all the time, your confidence grows. And then you do drills in training where you have to come out of training with confidence. And Bob Wilson, my coach at Arsenal for, 15 years or so, he was brilliant at that, you know, of giving me confidence in training. You know, we would be doing drills and I would make a save, a really good save within two or three shots. And he'd be like, all right, out, that's it, next one in. You know, so then you go out of that session feeling really confident. And Bob was brilliant at that. You know, and goalkeepers, they build confidence in training. You can tell when a goalkeeper is looking really good, because they start making saves and they feel good about it. You know, and then obviously on the other side, you know, there's goalkeepers that let mistakes in. And then even in training, you can spot whether it's affecting them or not, you know, and that tells you how they're going to be able to cope in a match day situation.
Is that something that you can, you know, if a player or a person is that way inclined, where things get on top of them, that must be a really slow process to try and build them to the point where they can deal with situations like that? Because I get, you know, every personality is different. Every character is different. Some people can make a mistake and just go, okay, look, that happened, I'm going to get on with it. Others maybe shrink a little, or they feel guilty. They feel like they've let the team or the fans down, whatever it might be. You know, that must take some time to sort of readjust or recalibrate their mindset.
It does. And, you know, trust me, I did it obviously in the World Cup in 2002. And, you know, I got tons of experience, but it still affected me. You know, afterwards, I was so emotional, you know, because of what you just said. You feel like you've let everyone down. But it's something that, especially nowadays, a lot of the goalkeepers and a lot of the players, they see sports psychologists, and they've got tools in place to try and deal with it. You know, but I think more than anything, you're born with that sort of character. You know, and especially if you've made the choice of being a goalkeeper, then you've got that sort of character.
Well, that's true. Yeah, I mean, it's quite interesting, though, when you talk about that. You think about the two goalkeepers that Arsenal have at the moment, Aaron Ramsdale and Bernd Leno. They seem to me, anyway, to be quite different characters. I mean, Ramsdale is a bit more outward. Leno, much more quietly efficient. I mean, there's the old adage about goalkeepers needing to be a little bit crazy. But I mean, is there a one size fits all kind of thing with goalkeepers? You know, some guys can be this, some guys can be that. There is a difference between the two fellas at Arsenal right now.
Yeah. Well, and you look at like when I was playing, there was me, you know, who looked calm and assured and confident. And then you look at Peter Schmeichel, you know, who was so animated. And that's how he got the best out of himself, is being so angry with other people. But that's two totally different ways of being a goalkeeper. And we both did okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, but like you say, but with Aaron and Leno, Bernd Leno, it's... two totally different characters. Aaron loves to be more vocal, you know, and shouting to his defenders, whereas Bernd seems to just get on with his game. But it's two different ways of being a goalkeeper, you know, and you can't say, well, that's right and that's wrong.
Yeah.
You know, because Burnt's career speaks for itself. You know, he's been at Arsenal for quite a while now. And to be fair, you know, he's done quite well. You know, it's just that Aaron's got in and he's really took on to it. You know, he's showing confidence. The fans love him. You know, even after when he first signed, you know, the fans were questioning, you know, why have we spent that much money, especially when Martinez left to go to Villa, you know, and it was a really tough time for him. And I put it out on Twitter. I said, look, you know, I had this when I first came to Arsenal. I took over from a fan's favourite in John Lukey. And the Arsenal fans were singing to me when I was at QPR, you'll never play for Arsenal. Yeah, I bet I do.
Have you been surprised by how quickly Ramsdale has changed people's minds? I think, you know, to be fair, I think there was sort of a general, not distrust, but I think people needed to be convinced that the club were, you know, doing smart business, because there have been some deals in the not too distant past which haven't appeared to be that smart. So there was some skepticism about, well, if we're going to bring in a young goalkeeper, he's played for Bournemouth and he's got relegated. He played for Sheffield United. He got relegated. And clearly there's a lot more to a team getting relegated than just the goalkeeper. Yeah. So it's not just on him, but are you surprised with how quickly he has managed to turn that situation around and to even get in the team? I mean, I think we all thought that when Arsenal spent 20-odd million pounds on a goalkeeper, they weren't spending it on a number two goalkeeper. They were spending it on somebody who they thought at least could really, really push for that number one position. But it happened a bit more quickly than I thought it would, and that many people thought it would. And, you know, things can change very quickly in football, as we know, but it feels like there's no looking back at this point.
Yeah, you know, and he's come in and, like you say, he looks confident. But that goes back to what I was saying about goalkeepers, they need to play. You know, Aaron's had a full season at Bournemouth playing in the top division, a full season at Sheffield United playing in the top division. You know, so he's got all that experience behind him. So it's not a massive step to come in and play at Arsenal, but it's still a big step because Arsenal's such a big club. And he's done it with confidence. He's done it with his own style. And I think that's what the fans love. You know, he likes to get the fans involved, especially before the games, you know, and he's very animated and he's always shouting. And, you know, so I think the fans just took to him easily because, plus the fact that he was making saves as well. And then the results started to change. You know, the team started to play better. We started getting a few wins behind our belt. And then, you know, that all them little bits just add to everything. And the fans have got total confidence in him now.
Seeing him on the training ground, what has impressed you most about the way that he plays? He is very vocal. He is animated. He does G people up and all of that kind of stuff. But you've got to match that with your goalkeeping skills as well. So on the training ground and in the games, is there one aspect of his game in particular which has really impressed you?
From what I've seen in training, his foot speed. His foot speed is so fast, you know, and it's something that a lot of people wouldn't really notice. But if you watch him, his feet are like pitter-patter all the time. They're not making big strides. And then that helps him to be able to push either way. You know, that's one of the first things that I noticed about him was how fast he was. And he just seems to be getting better and better because, you know, he's got some good coaches at Arsenal who are teaching him well. Mm. But he's, at the end of the day, it's about how he performs as a goalkeeper. And, you know, you just have to put your hands up and say he's doing brilliantly, which he is, you know. Excuse me. He's making big saves as well, you know, at crucial times in games. You know, even the Tottenham game when he made the save, pushed it onto the crossbar, which was a really vital save. Okay, there wasn't much time left, but 3-2, then that's a little bit of a different story. But he's just played so well, you know, and that's why, you know, me and the fans love him.
Yeah, I mean, it would have made those final few minutes a bit more hairy than we would have liked, for sure, in a North London derby. When you talk about foot speed, are you talking in particular about, you know, the way that he travels across his area, the way that he moves to position himself? And does that also take into account what he does on the ball? Because I think we've seen something of an evolution over the last number of years at Arsenal. Petr Cech came in, and when you think about it now, with all due respect to him, he feels like something of a throwback. And when he arrived at Chelsea, he was a phenomenal goalkeeper and felt really modern. Came to Arsenal, the playing out from the back thing didn't really suit him. And then Bernd Leno came in and, you know, he felt like an upgrade in that aspect of the game. For sure, he was more comfortable on the ball. But what we're seeing with Aaron Ramsdale is this, it was like another level to it where the sorts of passes that he is making into midfield, playing people down the line, the accuracy of his, and speed, I think, as well, of his mid to long distribution is really another step forward again. So does that all come back to this foot speed thing? Is that just natural ability with the ball at his feet?
Yeah, it comes back to the foot speed. It comes back to confidence. You know, and the other thing, the main thing is, he's what, 23 now?
Mm.
And he's been coached that way. You know, he's been coached to be able to play with the ball at his feet. You know, when Cech went in, it was so obvious that he hadn't been coached that way. If I'd have gone in, I would have looked like Petr Cech. But I would have made the decision not to do it early. I wouldn't embarrass myself that much for so long. You know, it was tough to watch, you know, because you're thinking, you've obviously been told you've got to do it this way, but it's not the best part of his game. You know, Petr Cech was a fantastic goalkeeper. You know, but it's sad because people remember that, you know, because it didn't look comfortable for him. But in Aaron, you've got a guy that's been coached, or Bernd's been coached that way as well. You know, if I had to deal with the new back pass rule, I'm sure they can deal with playing the ball out from the back.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, this is it. This is the evolution of the position as well.
Yeah.
I mean, I want to ask you a little bit about this sort of dynamic that now exists at Arsenal, where Aaron Ramsdale is the number one for now, but Bernd Leno, who's a hugely experienced goalkeeper and international for Germany, he is in the number two position. But how long can that last when you've got two goalkeepers of that quality and that caliber? And goalkeeper in particular is a position where if you can help it, you don't really rotate. So it makes it a little more difficult for clubs to build their squads and to, like, everyone wants, if something happens to Aaron Ramsdale, you want a good slash great goalkeeper to come in and take his place. But it's very, very difficult to keep two really, really good goalkeepers happy at any one club, isn't it?
It is, and it's hard. It's a decision that's tough to make, you know, because, like you say, so as in Bernd's situation, he's not going to be happy. He's not going to be happy not playing. He's going to be wanting to play. You know, if it's somewhere else, then you can understand. You know, it's a bit like with the Martinez situation. You know, he wanted to be a number one, and that's why he went to Villa. I think it's tough to try and keep them happy as both of them because, like, you know, as we saw with the game against Leeds, you know, Bernd went in there, still really, really great standard. But that's the only time he's going to play, maybe FA Cup or the League Cup. Mm. And, you know, for someone like that, I would imagine that that's quite frustrating for him. But if Mikel Arteta can keep them both happy, then that's brilliant. But, you know, I think that might be a different situation come January or maybe next summer.
How, you know, we talked about Aaron Ramsdale being very vocal and talking a lot. How much does that depend on the kind of players that you're playing behind? So you talked, obviously, throughout your career, you were a very calm goalkeeper. How much did it allow you to remain calm when you had that back four playing in front of you?
The back four were brilliant.
Yeah.
You know, there's no doubt about that. You know, Lee Dixon, Tony Adams, Steve Bold, Mike Keown, and then Nigel Winterburn as well.
Mm.
You know, they were brilliant, and it weren't through look or anything like that, is through the sheer hard work. You know, the amount of drills that George Graham used to put that back four through was amazing, but it worked. You know, then having that in front of you, when they know where, if somebody moves out of position, they cover for each other. They knew everything about each other.
Mm.
And for me, it was easy because, you know, I would just have to, like, shout whether there'd be a runner or whether, like, man on, you know, they've got to get marked quick, you know, all that sort of stuff. It was quite easy for me to talk to them. And that's what I liked. I didn't used to keep talking when the ball was, like, maybe halfway line or even a bit further away, because if you keep talking too much, they switch off. You know, what I used to do is I wait till the ball got close, you know, in and around the area. And then that's when I would start doing my commands, you know, and they like that. You know, they did. Tony said to me, he says, I don't like a goalkeeper that's shouting all the time. You know, so then you learn what to do.
And it's different, obviously, for Aaron Ramsdale, because I think he's coming into a defensive unit, which is a bit more, well, you know, it's newer, it's developing. We're seeing some partnerships develop. Ben White and Gabriel look quite good together. Kieran Tierney spends most of his time in the opposition half, getting forward and bombing down the left. And we have Tommy Asu at right back. So I think his role in being an organizer, somebody who's going to glue that together, is quite interesting.
It is, you know, and he'll learn. And like I say, he's only, what, 23? So he's still really young, but he will learn to tell players, you know, sometimes to just sit back, you know, or maybe get Thomas Partey to just sit in front of the defenders, you know, and give these sort of commands when you're in a match situation and when you can feel that we're under pressure a little bit. We used to do it a lot with Patrick, Patrick Vieira. We'd be like, I'd say to Tony, get Patrick to sit in front for 10 minutes while we're under all this pressure. And you know, little stuff like that used to go on all around the defence. And Aaron's got, he'll learn that, you know, but it comes to experience and then in gaining his confidence, you know, because now at the moment he's in the team and he's like, he's loving playing in the team. But then he'll take that another step further by, you know, not just being in the team, but affecting the team as well.
We have a couple of questions from our listeners who are on our Discord, and Lowy133 wants to know, as one of the best penalty savers of all time, how would you deal with the new style of penalties where the taker waits for the keeper to move? And did you have stats like modern goalkeepers?
No, I never had any stats. I just used to take it off the cuff. The angle at which they approached the ball decided to me which way I would go. And it's, but what I would wait for is, you watch the penalty takers, they come in looking at you, but at the last second they look down to strike the ball, and as soon as they look down, that's when I would go.
Right.
And then with the guys that hesitate, just stand up, wait for them, you know, because the guys that do that are the best penalty takers. You looked at Jorginho at Chelsea, he's brilliant at that, you know. But you've got to learn, you've got to watch and watch what he does, you know. It's on TV, it's there for you to see. You know, and then you think, what else can I do that might make him miss it? You know, don't just try and take him on at what he does, because he's really at it. But do something different, like throw a dummy and go the other way. You know, throw two dummies and go, you know, all that. You know, just watch it on TV and watch and see what else you could do as a goalkeeper.
Was that something you did, you know, study penalty takers?
Yeah, I studied them a little bit, you know, because it was... Back in the day, the only different penalty you would get would be like the chip down the middle. I remember Dwight York doing me like that when he was playing for Villa.
Yeah.
You know, but, you know, like you say, my record in penalties and penalty shootouts was quite good. And, you know, I was pretty consistent at going the right way. But it was just one of those things. It was just about, I kept watching penalties, kept looking at the angle they approached the ball, and then thinking, yeah, that's going to work. And luckily for me, it worked quite a few times.
It did, all right. I remember many of them. General General Baez says, who was the toughest to play against during training at Arsenal?
Oh, the toughest players in training. Martin Keown, all day long. He was a nutter.
Would he even terrorise you?
Yeah, you know, but not really. You know, but he was tough to play against, you know. And people like Patrick would always come in, and like if I went up for a cross, he would always be there, like messing about, but elbowing me and stuff like that. You know, so in training it was a little bit different. But Thierry was always brilliant in training, you know, because he was brilliant on the pitch as well. You know? And you've got people like Dennis Bergkamp that could put it in from anywhere around your penalty area. You know, so there's people like that. But I tell you, who really, really impressed me when he first came was Nicholas Anelka.
When he
came as a 17-year-old, he was frighteningly good. And it was so raw, it was great to see. It was great to see Tony Adams and Steve Bould trying to kick him, and they still couldn't catch him.
And he had amazing power, because I remember that first goal that he scored in the game against Manchester United. It was one of those shots from the edge of the box that absolutely flew past Peter Schmeichel.
He did. He had what you call a short back lift. You know, so he didn't really wind up, but he could generate so much power in a little amount of space with his foot, and he was special. He was better than Thierry when he first came. Obviously, Thierry developed into a much better player. And Nicholas, you know, didn't stay at the club long enough for me, but Nicholas Anelka was some player.
Johnny B AFC says, what's your favourite save? And I think we have to leave aside the Sheffield United one, which of course is an amazing one. So what's your second favourite save?
Obviously my Sheffield United save was amazing, and And I was 39 when I made that save, you know. So it was really self-pleasing for me. Second favourite, I tell you what, I really enjoyed the penalty shootout at Sampdoria.
Yeah.
And I say three penalties, you know, that was special. You know, and I've got great photographs afterwards where the lads have like lifted me up onto their shoulders and carried me across the pitch to the Arsenal fans, you know. So stuff like that is just amazing. And it's just great memories. I've got so many good memories of winning trophies, you know, and it's something that's just so pleasing.
I remember that penalty shootout against Sampdoria because I was working on a radio station in Tipperary, and it was mid-90s, obviously, and I was supposed to be, you know, concentrating on my radio show, but I had the TV on in the studio. I was watching that penalty shootout, so I may have made a mistake or two in terms of the songs or the things that I said on the radio that night, but more than worth it. Before we go, I mean, you're doing a podcast now called Seaman Says, so before I ask you a little bit about, you know, what you're doing exactly, are you enjoying doing that? Because that is, you know, something a little bit different where you're talking to people. You've spoken to obviously some former teammates and great people from the world of football. How do you find that in general?
Yeah, I'm quite enjoying it, you know, surprisingly, you know, because when I was first asked to do it, which was to cover the Euros, I thought, you know, there's going to be a lot to talk about, obviously, with England.
Mm.
And then it developed, you know, and then they asked me to do the whole season. So, you know, it's been great. You know, like you say, I've had a lot of my teammates, like, you know, Lee, Tony, Wrighty, Nigel. Lots of my teammates have been on there, but a few good surprise names coming up later as well. You know, so it's just something that I'm getting into, and I'm enjoying it the more and more that I do it.
Have you got a dream guest that you would like to have on the show?
A dream guest would have been someone like Seve Ballesteros, who was my childhood hero. You know, I just loved the way that he handled himself and the competitive spirit that he had. You know, so he would have been my dream guest. But there's a few coming up. You know, you have to subscribe to see who it is. You know, but you'll be surprised with some of the names.
All right. Well, we look forward to that. The podcast is called Seaman Says. You can get it wherever you get podcasts. We'll put links to the show and the Twitter and everything else in the show notes on this one. But for now, we'll leave it there. David Seaman, thank you very much. A pleasure to talk to you.
Cheers. Thanks very much.
Well, hope you enjoyed that. It was great to talk to David Seaman. You can find him on Twitter @TheDavidSeaman. But of course, the podcast is called Seaman Says. Twitter for that is @SeamanPodcast. And the website you can find it on is SeamanSays.co.uk. Of course, you can get the pod wherever you get podcasts. You know the drill. Just pick your favorite podcasting app, search for Seaman Says, and subscribe to hear guests like Ian Wright, Tony Adams, Lee Dixon, John Bond, Barnes, Peter Schmeichel, and loads more besides. So thank you very much indeed to him for his time. Thank you as well to Pascal Hughes and also to Callum Marks for helping me organize that. It was a great chat, and I hope you guys enjoyed it. Thanks to you too for your help in making it happen.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary. Not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Okay, joining me now on the Arsecast to talk about some bits and bobs that have been going on in the football world in general, and of course Arsenal, from CBS Sports, it's James Benge. Hi, James.
Hi, Andrew. How you doing?
I'm good, thank you. I want to talk a bit about managers. And obviously, Mikel Arteta has been a manager in the spotlight for a while for various reasons. Everybody knows what they are. And this week, Ole Gunnar Solskjaer was a manager in the spotlight for very obvious reasons as Manchester United got absolutely, well, Tottenham-style battered, you would say, by Liverpool at Old Trafford. And there was talk about whether he's the right man for the job, and Gary Neville on Sky afterwards was like, I never call for a manager to be sacked. And I thought this was quite an interesting thing because I don't remember necessarily that being such an issue before, when managers have been underperforming. Pundits have often said, well, they're not going to come out and say, look, he should be sacked. Some of them will, but like for the most part, people couch their words. But I've never understood quite why people within the game of football themselves take umbrage at things like this. I'll give you a couple of examples. Phil Neville responded to a tweet from Miguel Delaney. Miguel said something along the lines of, this is a sacking offence, or this should be a sacking offence based on the United performance against Liverpool. And Phil Neville replied saying, well, you feel good tweeting that, do you? And there was another bit this week where he said, we live in an era where it's seen as quite normal to ask people to be sacked, which I find absolutely incredible. If you were in any other workplace and you walked into a shop and you said, I want you to be sacked, I think you would be reported to the police. Now, clearly there's a slight difference between just walking into a shop and, you know, taking aim at a shopkeeper and, you know, fans who go to a stadium when they pay season ticket prices and all that kind of stuff. It's a little bit of a different thing. So I'm curious as to your thoughts on you know, there's a mates thing going on here with Phil Neville and Solskjaer and all that. But in general, where is the line between what a pundit can and can't say or shouldn't say about a manager who's perhaps underperforming, or definitely underperforming?
No, he's definitely underperforming. I mean, I suppose you just want people to be honest in their opinions, and perhaps Gary Neville's opinion on Ole Gunnar Solskjaer is that, yes, you know, he's not playing well, but he still believes he should be in the job. Mm. But I think the issue with Neville's punditry on Sunday, and obviously it is nearly uniformly excellent, I think, and you know, he is someone that we all learn a lot from when he speaks, but was that you got the sense he was kind of arguing against what he probably thought deep down, but just against everything that was being presented to him. And he was not engaging with the issue. I think it was very interesting that Carragher and Souness kept saying to him, look, we're not trying to bait you into saying this manager should be sacked. And I do understand the hesitancy of having that conversation, because and Arsenal fans, I think, should understand better than anyone else, because it's only 4 or 5 years ago that we were sort of having these internal and external conversations about Arsene Wenger and how uncomfortable it feels asking for any manager to be sacked. But particularly, I think, with Wenger, it was very tough because he's someone that people have invested emotionally an awful lot in. Obviously, that's, you know, this is different with Solskjaer. He is a man who kind of lucked into a job, has had some success, but ultimately has probably not taken a team where he should go. And I think the frustration there was almost that Neville was looking for reasons to not tell the truth. I mean, the one thing that really stood out to me was when he said, you know, I don't know what the coaches do all day, so I can't judge them on that. But you go, well, everything that the coaches do builds towards the performance on the pitch. Mm. You know, this is the equivalent of, you know, let's take it back to Phil Neville's supermarket metaphor. You know, everything that your checkout staff does that builds towards how they do your groceries. And if, you know, if Manchester United are continually not performing on the pitch, of course you can, you know, there are other factors that will influence that, but ultimately that responsibility there lies on the coaching staff. So you can't sort of say, I don't see what they're doing day to day, so I can't hold them responsible, when what they do day to day is designed to maximize performances on the pitch. It's awkward having the conversation where you, or writing the piece or saying the words, you know, I think a manager should be sacked. I went as close as I thought I would want to go to that conversation with Mikel Arteta after the Villarreal game. And I, you know, personally, I still have doubts about whether he's the right manager. But I think the one thing is, you know, when you say that, you probably can't really take it back. you will, you know.
You can admit you're wrong, though. Let's say, yeah, you know, let's say it all goes, you know, swimmingly from here on in. And I'm not saying it's going to. And I think, you know, most people listening to this, you know, have seen what's gone on. And you can have doubts about what's going on at Arsenal over Mikel Arteta to varying degrees, of course. But, you know, there's no reason why, if things go brilliantly, you can't say, well, you know what? I got that wrong. I feel like there's sort of a reluctance at times to do that, in particular in an industry where things can change really, really quickly. You know, you can go from being quite assured in your position to absolutely teetering on the brink. And that's a reality, I think, that most of the people who work in football, particularly as managers and coaches, will understand how cutthroat the industry is. Like the old, what do you call it, the boardroom... what is it where the chairman comes out and says that we've got faith in the manager? Oh,
the dreaded vote of confidence.
The dreaded vote of confidence. This is not a new invention. That's been in football for as long as I can remember. So there is this understanding among everybody who works in football that this is the reality of the game, that your job, which could be perfectly safe in 2 months' time, you could be absolutely on the brink of sack because results or performances just aren't there.
And when push comes to shove, you know, Ole Gunnar Solskjaer will be paid millions of pounds to go away. You know, one sympathizes with Solskjaer's emotional investment. And when I put this out on Twitter, I didn't get many people agreeing with me, but I thought it was quite sad seeing Solskjaer look so devastated when he was walking down the touchline. It might have been like funny at 2-3-0. At 5, it was like, oh, I don't like watching this anymore.
I thought it was very funny. But that's, you know, we're different people, James, and we can...
but in the end, he's going to pocket several million pounds to not be Manchester United manager anymore, which when you kind of go back to what Phil Neville's saying, you know, if you get sacked, most people, when they get sacked from their jobs, do not receive the vast majority of their contract paid out to them in full. Like Solskjaer, let's be honest, will when he gets sacked. I think that's one of the things that maybe pundits and people talking about this do need to understand when they're in the world of football, that the real world out there is very different, that a lot of people, especially over the last 18 months, have probably been clinging on to jobs quite tenuously and really worrying about where the next paycheck's coming from. And they would have loved for someone to pay them to not work and to go and find a new job. I think that side of it gets really forgotten. Yes, it's sad for a manager when they lose their job. And, you know, it's sad to see what people were saying about Steve Bruce. And it does go too far, and it goes too far with what some people say about Solskjaer. But you shouldn't be coming into the job blind to that. Mm. You know, you shouldn't be coming into any public facing job blind to the fact that this is 2021 and there are some nasty people out there who will take valid criticism way beyond that into abusive territory.
Yeah, well, I mean, and that's not to condone abuse, and I know that's not what you're saying at all. It is an unfortunate reality. I don't think it's a pleasant thing, and I don't think it's something that necessarily should be tolerated, but it is the reality of football that you do have a public-facing job. And I think the interesting aspect of it is, like, it's not like you have to stand up on a soapbox and demand that this fraud be beheaded in front of the Old Trafford crowd, you know, let him pay for his many sins that he has inflicted upon them, you know, by getting them to second place last year and ultimately being the former manager of Cardiff, who isn't quite good enough to be manager of Manchester United. Heaven forbid, who could have seen that coming? But, you know, you can say things and you can have an opinion and you can have a strong opinion on something, but you can elucidate that quite respectfully. You know, and I think that sometimes is the thing that people can't quite get their head around, that by saying something, you don't have to be super hyper aggressive about it. You can literally say, well, I think he's taken this job as far as he can take it. The natural consequence of that is that somebody else has got to come in. You don't have to call for him to be sacked, but you can have the opinion which basically backs that up, you know.
And even calling for him to be sacked, I wouldn't necessarily consider that to be an attack on an individual. You know, I think there was an appropriate time where it was fair to call for Antonio Conte to be sacked at Chelsea in that second year because things weren't working. And, you know, we all know when we talk about football that there are sometimes bigger, you know, there are bigger decisions that you might like to take that might address things. You know, everyone quite often will blame the players, but we all know you can't sack the playing staff. You can't just go, these players, we replace the players en masse. Mm. And that fundamentally, you know, the whole world of football knows that in the end, part of the job of being manager is that you're quite often the one that carries the can for structural issues, for decisions that weren't made by you. You know, one might argue that Ole Gunnar Solskjaer is going to lose the job he's got because he was handed probably not the player he needed, a defensive midfielder. He's not alone in making these decisions. And then he was sort of tasked with dealing with making Cristiano Ronaldo work in 2021, which is actually a lot more difficult than it looks considering his goal return. You know, that's part of the job of being a manager is that you have to accept that you're the one that carries the can for decisions and mistakes you haven't made. And therefore, you know, I've said Man United should sack Solskjaer. It's not just Solskjaer's fault, but he's also the one thing that you can change immediately that might have an immediate impact.
Yeah, I suppose as well, when you go to a club like Manchester United, which is, you know, as the signing of Ronaldo showed, it is being run first and foremost as a marketing franchise and secondly as a football club, you know, because when you look at some of the talent that United have going forward to sort of place this, albeit enormously talented, shiny-necked player like Ronaldo in there, it just is a roadblock, you know. And like you say, that's not necessarily Solskjaer's fault, and maybe he didn't have the authority to overrule that decision for him to come in, but he can also pick the team that he wants to pick, unless there's some sort of contractual thing going on there that we don't know about, which wouldn't be a surprise.
Again, that's the tough, if you're getting the Manchester United job, those are the sort of tough things that you have to deal with. You have to deal with the politics of, you know, maybe you should go and drop Ronaldo if you're going to go and play Tottenham on Saturday. Maybe that's, and it's just, this just has to be accepted that this is par for the course. You know, there is so much that comes manager's way that isn't, but a simple conversation about whether or not they're good enough for the job, as you say, Andrew, it's just not an unreasonable debate to have. And what's frustrating is it that gets bound together with some of the unreasonable stuff that was being said to Steve Bruce. You know, that's not fair. But a lot of what Newcastle fans were saying about Steve Bruce was totally fair. And the same, you know, the same with any manager. A lot of the stuff that's said about Mikel Arteta is not fair. A lot of the people that drop into all our replies on Twitter with their weird profile pictures, that's not fair. That's not reflective of, you know, a man that's trying to do a good job in trying circumstances. But Mikel Arteta is nowhere near above criticism. That's what kind of Neville almost demanded of Solskjaer. You can't criticise him. That was wrong.
Moving on, there was a talk of the five subs rule becoming a permanent thing this week. And I think people have quite mixed opinions on this. I saw Michael Cox talk about it and bemoan the fact that this is going to, who's zonal marking, of course, you know, that this is going to give an advantage to the biggest teams, to the richest teams. And I think that's a very, very fair point of view, to be honest. You know, if you've got five subs that you can use and all five of those subs are world-class players because you've got, you know, strength and depth and you've got the financial resources to build a squad like that, it gives you an advantage. I know people will say, well, you know, other teams can come in and they can bring on players who can, you know, deal with the talent because they've got more energy and they can, you know, add legs and those kind of things. But I do think ultimately when you've got more talent to put on the pitch at any time, it gives you a significant advantage. So I think it's an interesting idea. I'm curious as to your general thoughts on it before I grill you on a couple of specifics.
I do agree with everything Michael said. I'm conscious this isn't a Man United podcast and we've spoken a lot more about Man United than Arsenal, but there was a great example in 1920.
I remember
2019-20.
Not 1920.
The FA Cup tie between Norwich and Man United. Norwich were 1-0 up, I think. And Solskjaer just unloaded this like raft of talent off the bench. It was sort of Pogba, Rashford. You know, he named a weakened side, but it didn't matter that he named a weakened side because half of it was changed by the full time whistle, and they won it in the end. And I mean, I seem to remember as well in that in that FA Cup run for Arsenal, you kind of, you just kept looking to the bench, especially in that City semi-final, and it was like, oh God, which superstar £50 million forward are they about to unleash on an ailing David Luiz right now? That will significantly spoil games. I think maybe less in the Premier League, because a lot of teams have, even if they don't have five world-class players on the bench, they probably have five players of commensurate quality to the players they put on the pitch. I think in, you know, in the Champions League, in the European competitions, Premier League clubs are going to find it even easier. Having said that, I like it because I think it will make for more interesting football. I think this could get more tactically intriguing. I mean, I mentioned it, I'm sure we'll come on to it, my slightly mad idea if I had to use these five subs. But it does add a little bit more intrigue. I think it gives managers more that they can do. It offers more sort of flexibility within games. And also, and this isn't an insignificant factor, you know, for Arsenal, someone like Gabriel Martinelli, Flo Balogun, Salah on Wednesday night, they're not getting chances at all, because one sub you can pretty much give over to an injured player, then one where Arteta needs to introduce someone to hold up the midfield, and then you need a steady pair of hands. So I think it will be a significant boost to development of young players that you can just, you know, you've got those extra subs.
Sure.
That you can
make. I mean, wouldn't that be an interesting aspect of it, though, where if you're, or if the intention is to, you know, to try and give younger players more chances and to develop them and to give them opportunities that maybe they won't. And I think you're right to say that if you have five subs, you know, if Arsenal, imagine, are 4-0 up in a game in the 70th minute, we haven't made any changes, and you've got like two or three, you know, young players on the bench, you can give them a go. You can give them some minutes. You can give them some experience. You know, maybe one of the ways of equalizing this, would be to mandate that the third and fourth sub, or the fourth and fifth sub, for example, must be an academy player, rather than your £70 million signing from the summer, your £50 million signing from the summer before, your world-class winger slash striker slash, you know, attacking midfield player that you can keep in reserve because you're Man City, because you're Manchester United, because you've got these deep resources, you know, a club, you know, the clubs with the most money in the Premier League, you know, the Chelsea, City, Newcastle, they'll get there in the end. You know, there are teams who just cannot compete with that. But if there's some measure of equalization because you have to use academy players, that might make it a little bit more fair, and it might also provide opportunities for players who probably aren't going to get them unless they go on loan to, you know, a championship side or something like that.
Yeah, I'd not thought of that. I really like that idea. I've not got many complaints about. The other one that I've heard pitched in the past is that you can name an unlimited number of under 21 or academy graduates on your bench, just to, and maybe limit the number of non-homegrown or non, however you want to define it, you limit the number of them on the bench. I think anything like that would be great. You're going to have to make the most out of this, do what you can to redress it so that it isn't just anytime City are a goal down, it's sort of like, right, unleash Foden, De Bruyne, all that lot on the bench.
Yeah. You had another mad idea, which sounds, you know, it does sound a bit mad to me when we were talking about it before, but basically a kind of rolling subs idea?
Yeah, a bit like that. So partly it just comes from my mad love of basketball and the NBA. But I would be intrigued as to whether, so you allow for five changes. I think maybe you would have to do it in five blocks rather than the four it will be in the future, but that if you take a player off, you can bring them back on. Now, I mean, part of the reason for this, I think, is maybe the player welfare angle that we haven't discussed, but managers really like to, where if a player takes a knock, or, I mean, the example I gave to you was Ben White on Wednesday night or Tuesday night, feeling a bit of a dicky tummy, let's get him off. Let's let him
do his business,
whatever he needs to do. And look, you know, I'm sure this is a rule that back in the 90s, Gary Lineker would have been very in favour of. let's get them out to do their business, but also to, you know, to check on the state of an injury. And then, you know, if a manager wants, they can re-enter the fray. I mean, it's something they do in rugby as well. They have, you know, blood subs and things like that.
Mm.
Also, I think the other way to look at it is it could be quite intriguing tactically. I know when Mikel Arteta was asked some sort of questions by fans, one of the ones that he looked really intrigued by was the idea that substitutes might be like, you might have closers. You could have a player that starts the game, ends the game. I think that would be, you know, going back to Martinelli, I imagine how good he might be if you kind of run him at full pelt for 15 minutes, withdraw him for someone, you know, that's more possession oriented and then grind the team down. Martinelli goes back in. I mean, you've used two subs to do that, so it's a risk. With all these things, I'd just like to see how it works. I don't know if it would work, but if someone fancies doing it in the League Cup, I'll give it a watch.
Yeah, I mean, the other thing that springs to mind for me on this, you know, the idea that you can use five subs, I wonder, is it a, you know, we've heard Thibaut Courtois talk about player welfare and the amount of football that they've got to play at the moment and how ultimately they're going to get injured, players are going to get fatigued and all that kind of stuff. It doesn't seem realistic to me that the people who run football, all of these vested interests with marketing deals and sponsorship deals, and the more football that's on TV, the better it is for all of them. And the more games they play, the more revenue they have, the more match tickets they sell, the more merchandising they sell, all of those things. Like the juggernaut is rolling, you know, the Rolling Stone is gathering all this, you know, fantastically expensive dollar and pound and euro moss as it goes downhill. They don't want to do away with any of that. So as a kind of sop to player welfare, we'll give you an extra couple of subs, and that will mean that, like, you know, we don't have to change the schedule. We don't have to reduce the workload on the players. You can look after the players by, you know, taking them off 10 minutes before you might normally do it. You know, a guy who would play 90 minutes now is going to play 80 minutes, as if that's going to make a significant impact on his welfare.
Yeah, it is. It, as you say, it is a slightly disingenuous way of solving the problem, because, you know, we know there are never going to be fewer games. They had a great chance to do that last season. It would have been quite a good season to give the EFL Cup a rest, but that cost the EFL money. And, you know, exactly as you put it, there will be more games, I'm sure, in 10 years time than there are now. People will be squeezing in friendly tournaments, international, whatever. So, like you say, I think maybe the next step will not be easing player workload anyway. It might be seven subs. It's not great. Eventually, it will get to the stage where it sort of turns all games into glorified friendlies. You remember, like, you know, those mid-2000s games where you'd have a whole different team for the second half. But, yeah, as you say, the one thing we can be pretty certain on is that no one with a financial interest in this sport is going to go, yeah, we're willing to sacrifice that for the good of the players.
No, not a bit. Right, let's talk Arsenal a little bit. And midweek there was a win over Leeds in the Carabao Cup, which I fully expected Manchester City to win, but of course they went out of it. So the pathway is now clear for Arsenal, you know, for Mikel Arteta to fully assume Pep Guardiola's mantle in that regard by winning the
You think he'll give it to him if he wins? He'll just bring him Guardiola his own mini League Cup. This was for you, Pep.
Maybe Mikel Arteta will be presented with a Pep Guardiola-shaped trophy if we actually manage to win that, which would be something. But look, Arsenal made 9 changes. There were some players in the team who, you know, realistically don't have a great future in red and white. There are some young players in there, maybe not as many as people might have liked. But even with 9 changes against a Leeds team who, you know, have been difficult to play against under Marcelo Bielsa, maybe not quite on Tuesday night. They weren't the leads that I had expected. 2-0 win, a clean sheet. It does keep this little bit of momentum going, you know, and when you're looking for positives, when you're looking for things to be encouraged about, I think that goes in that column pretty well.
Yeah, with a game like this, I kind of was going into it thinking it's really important not to lose, actually, and therefore, you know, to win. Just because things were feeling quite positive, and I think kind of maybe one of the frustrating stories of Arteta's tenure is there hasn't been a real run.
Yeah,
maybe in lockdown there was a little bit of one, but it's, you know, even if there hasn't been anything like that Emery run where you knew it was a bit false, you knew that there were issues still. but the players just sort of started enjoying winning and games an awful lot. And eight games now is not insignificant. It's not a bad run of results at all. I mean, I thought there were, footballing wise, there was very little to take. I think the fact that Leeds are both a very particular team and a team that's doing what they're doing not as well as they used to means I don't know what I take away from that. But I did really like Ainsley Maitland-Niles in midfield.
Agree.
I'd be intrigued to see how he gets on with Xhaka. I don't know if there'll be much time to do to try that out before Thomas Partey and Mohamed Elneny jet off. But it just sort of feels like, you know, Maitland-Niles brings the dynamism, can progress the ball up pitch by carrying, and then Xhaka's a bit more sedate, moves the ball with his passing. I'd be interested to see that, and I hope Mikel Arteta gets a chance to look at it before half his midfield goes.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think the other aspect is Maitland-Niles and Lokonga, and whether that could be a midfield partnership that might work. They do feel a little bit similar, you know, in terms of the way that they play. I'm not saying they're exactly the same, but, you know, it might be a case that Thomas Partey is gone before Granit Xhaka is back from injury, because they were quite clear that it was going to be 2022 for Granit Xhaka, regardless of how hard he works, unless they're, you know, setting the expectations quite high and do expect him back a bit sooner. But even still, he's going to take a little while to get back up to speed and what have you. So it might be a case that we're going into games where there is no Xhaka, there is no Partey, there is no Elneny, which does leave Mikel Arteta with not a great deal to choose from in that regard.
Yeah, when you put it like that, that is just very, very worrying. I really like Lokonga, and there's definitely a player there that in 2-3 years could be a consistent start, maybe even before then, could be a consistent starter for Arsenal. But, you know, we saw against Palace, he's got to learn by making mistakes. And as Arteta will say, we don't have time to teach people by making mistakes. So that is a really tough balancing act to hit. You would maybe hope that Xhaka, they're going to have to hope that Xhaka's ahead of schedule, or that something brings Partey back early. Equally, if Elneny was available, I just wouldn't bother anymore. He's a solid player. He never lets you down, but I thought it was quite apparent against Leeds that he just won't pass the ball forwards.
That is a fairly substantial issue, I think, for a midfield player. Like, I get the safety first thing. And I think, you know, on his best day, I think he can be a pretty useful player. But like we saw against Leeds, the limitations are very obvious, you know, for a team which is trying at least to be a bit more progressive in terms of how they play. I don't know how Elneny really fits into that. If you're talking about a player who's a closer, I think if you're 2-1 up and there's 5-10 minutes to go, bring Elneny on to press around in midfield, and that's where potentially he's the most useful. You also mentioned Gabriel Martinelli, and I think Tuesday was maybe a chance for him to impress, to show that, you know, he should be playing a bit more in the Premier League. I can understand why he isn't, to be honest, because, you know, the results have been decent of late. The performance is a little bit inconsistent. And that, I think, as you alluded to, is the next thing for Mikel Arteta, is to try and produce a bit more consistency with performance levels and how Arsenal play. But when you've got Aubameyang up front scoring the goals that he's scoring, Smith Rowe playing basically in the position on the left-hand side where Martinelli would play otherwise, you can see why he hasn't been in the team as much. I don't necessarily see this as a major, major issue. I know people like to project and say, well, he's going to be really pissed off, he's going to be annoyed. I saw that I was watching the bench cam when Arsenal scored the goals against Aston Villa. He looked absolutely delighted. He was tweeting about how much he likes to play, which is understandable and cool. But it feels like there is a bit of a gap, as I said to James on a Patreon podcast we did this week, James McNicholas, that there's sort of a gap between where Martinelli is now and the expectations and hopes that we have projected onto him, because we've seen him do some fantastic stuff in the past. There is just a little bit of a chasm there at the moment.
Yeah, and I think the hard thing is he's not earning the game time because he's not playing often enough, and therefore when he plays, he's not playing that well. I think, and we keep coming back to AFCON, it does feel like it may have a significant impact on Arsenal's season. But I mean, it will, may well open up opportunities, may well open minutes with no Pepe, no Aubameyang. I wonder if, though, after that, when the players start tripping back, is it worth getting him out on loan somewhere? It's got to be somewhere of a high standard. But I just don't, I don't think his development is being well served as is. Not least because when he comes on, it's often in, you know, desperate circumstances. And he's great there. You know, he was almost as important as Lacazette against Palace. But it's not that, you know, he's coming on and it's sort of like, don't show any inhibitions, throw yourself to the wind. I don't feel like we always see everything Martinelli can do, and we're not seeing him in a real Arteta structure. But like, that's not going to come when Emile Smith Rowe is looking like one of the best young players in England.
Yeah,
this is a great problem to have. And in the end, you know, Martinelli was a relatively low cost punt from Ituano, who's easily paid back everything that was invested in him. And, you know, if worse comes to worse and you decide to move on for him, would probably earn you a lot more than the 7 million you paid for him.
Mm.
It's a good problem to have, but I would like to see him spend the second half of the season out on loan, I think probably somewhere in Europe, just so he plays week in, week out, and we get a bit more of an idea.
I think that's interesting because, you know, like you say, the AFCON is going to have a big impact on what we can do with Aubameyang gone, with Pepe gone, with Partey gone. You know, those are key figures to varying degrees within the team, and you're going to need some variety. I think the thing with Martinelli for me is I'm not quite sure what exactly he is, what he's going to be. Is he going to be a striker? Is he going to be a wide player? I don't feel like the skill set is necessarily there for him to thrive, certainly in the system and the way that we play, as a sort of a possession-based winger, somebody who's going to fly up and down the left-hand side, beat his man. I feel like he needs to be a bit more of a penalty box player, which is why I think when he doesn't play, it's because Aubameyang is playing. I think probably the long-term view is for him to be a striker, but that pathway is quite substantially blocked when Aubameyang is playing and in the form that he's in.
Yeah, I mean, and on that, it might be quite fun to see him. I don't know how often they'll reprise this 4-4-2, but I think him and Lacazette would be quite a fun look. I don't think we've really seen those two play together all that much outside a bit of, I remember them playing in the Europa League under Ljungberg, and Martinelli had a great game there. But I think, yeah, I know Tim Stillman, I think, makes this point a lot. It is really hard to fit a lot of Arsenal's forwards in when they're quite broken play. They're not build-up oriented. You know, Pepe, I think you would argue, is the same. Certainly Aubameyang. And then they need to get minutes as well. And you can only have so many of them on the pitch at once. So, yeah, I feel like there's a lot I don't know about Martinelli. And a lot of this is equally, you know, you want to find it out. He feels like such a diamond in the rough. But I think we kind of, now that you know he is a potential starter, top level player, you need to kind of make sure you see what he can do in those circumstances. That won't come at Arsenal this season. It might in a few. So you need to make sure he's out on loan somewhere.
All right. Well, look, we'll see what happens. Who knows? He might pop up this weekend with a last gasp winner against Leicester City, which would be very nice indeed. James, we'll leave it there for now. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed to James. You can find him on Twitter @JamesBenj, and he does football stuff for CBS Sports. Right, that's just about that for this week's show. We do have a big game at the weekend, of course, playing Leicester on Saturday lunchtime. They're thereabouts. Yeah, 12:30 kickoff at the King Power Stadium, a difficult place to go, as we know. But hopefully we can continue the momentum that we've built over the last couple of weeks. If we can take as much of the Villa game into this one as possible, that would be great. We will have more discussion of the Leicester game itself over on Patreon. Lewis and I will be doing, as we always do, a Premier League preview podcast that will be available for you on Friday afternoon. So if you want to join up for that, you can do so at patreon.com/arsblog. patreon.com/arsblog. James and I will be here on Monday with an Arscast Extra. Hopefully it's a goodly morning. For now, though, thank you as ever for listening, for your support as always, for your comments, feedback, and all the rest of it. Much appreciated. Let's hope we have a great weekend, and we will catch you on the next one. Until then, cheers. Bye-bye.
Help me here. I need to speak to a manager at once. There's something terrible going on.
Manager required at till 4, please. Manager to till 4.
All right, sir. I'm the manager. How can I help you?
I'm Phil Neville, and I'm really upset because this employee has not done its job properly, and I demand that he is sacked.
So, let me get this straight. You've walked into this shop, and you've demanded that I sack somebody.
Yes, and now you all know how Ole Gunnar Solskjaer feels. He is a human being with feelings and a heart. How could you do this to him?
Right.
Now, are you going to sack this person, or am I going to call the police?
Well, I don't know about the police, sir, but you might want to call Specsavers. This is a self-service checkout.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.